for appellee. And also with me at council table is Mr. Joseph Strauss.
Welcome to the court.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and thank you for the inscribed volume as well.
You're welcome.
Good afternoon. Bruce Jamison on behalf of the appellant, the territory of the United States Virgin Islands. With me at council table is Scott Kalf of the law offices of Jack Dima, our co-counsel in this case, and also Melissa Donomersky of my office. Your Honor, may it please the court, the United States territory of the Virgin Islands appeals from the dismissal of claims that it brought in the Court of Chancery below, seeking recoupment of certain liquidating distributions that were made to the defendant Goldman Sachs and Co. In connection with the dissolution of a corporation known as Panex Industries, Inc. I will start with just a brief summary of the facts that are drawn mainly from the complaint that we filed in this action. On the island of St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands, there was a dry cleaning facility that was known as the Laga facility that was operated in the 1970s and caused pollution to the main freshwater aquifer on that island. Laga was owned by a company known as Duplan from 1970 to 1976 when Duplan filed for bankruptcy. As a result of the bankruptcy of Duplan, the Laga facility was sold to a company then known as Panex Co. and ultimately was then resold later to the government of the Virgin Islands. Duplan.
And what year was that? So that it was sold to the government of the Virgin Islands?
1981, Your Honor.
That's what I thought.
Duplan was reorganized. It came out of its bankruptcy as a reorganized entity known as Panex Industries, Inc. 3 years later, in 1984, Panex Industries filed a plan of dissolution, or rather sent a proxy statement to its stockholders recommending or seeking a stockholder vote on a plan of dissolution that had been approved and recommended by its board of directors. That plan of dissolution was approved. And ultimately, in connection with the plan of dissolution, approximately $64 million were distributed out to stockholders. And in addition, a liquidating trust was created, what I generally refer to as the Panex Trust or the original trust, that was charged with essentially overseeing the winding up of the corporation's affairs. $6 million were placed into that liquidating trust at the time that it was set up. The trust was created in September of 1995, and among its purposes, as stated in the trust document that created it, were satisfying any and all liabilities of Panex which are not paid or otherwise discharged.
When, in your view, would it be too late to bring an action, to bring this action?
Let me try to answer that this way, Your Honor. If the liquidating trust had not been created, in other words, had the corporation been dissolved, no successor entity had been in existence, the answer to your question would have been it would have been too late 3 years after the date of dissolution because there was no entity in existence then against which to bring claims, and pursuant to the operation of Section 278, the three-year period would have been applicable. However, in this circumstance, the answer is, so long as a successor entity remained in existence, which was charged with resolving and taking care of liabilities of the dissolved corporation, so long as such an entity existed, then the claim could be brought.
So it's for the life of the trust, however long that is?
Yes, with a caveat. The caveat is there was then a successor trust created by the Chancery Court below. The order governing that successor trust that was entered by the Chancery Court specifically said that only claims that had been brought or asserted as of the date that the successor trust was created could be brought. So there was specific language in the successor trust order that cut off any new claims after the date when the successor trust was created. So I have to modify my answer to say, claims could be brought up until the date that the original trust was terminated, or at least till the successor trust replaced it. After that date, only the claims that were recognized in the successor trust order, and there were a defined group of claimants, which included the United States Virgin Islands, only those claims could then be asserted.
So there's no doctrine of latches in the context of these liquidating trusts?
Correct, Your Honor. The United States Virgin Islands contends that latches is not applicable to this situation.
And is what case says that, if any?
Well, Your Honor, the doctrine of latches is, one, a fact-based inquiry. But the reason that we say that latches isn't applicable here is because our claim, that is, the claim of the Virgin Islands, did not arise until the default judgment was entered by the district court in the Virgin Islands. And that did not occur until 2005. The reason that we say that is the Virgin Islands was essentially a contingent creditor of either Panex, the company, or in reality, the successor trust, as we've approached this matter. However, the Virgin Islands had no ability to assert a claim against Goldman Sachs or against any other beneficiary of the trust or former stockholder of Panex unless and until there was some liability against the successor trust or the corporation that went unsatisfied.
Well, and on page 3 of the Vice Chancellor's opinion, he addresses that point, and he's not very charitable. He is responding to the argument it didn't accrue until 2005. It says the default judgment was entered when the fund had no money to defend itself. Then he goes on to say the inequity Goldman Sachs faces as a result of the Virgin Islands torpor is made even plainer. So to the extent that's your argument on appeal, where's the reversible error in the court's characterization of why we shouldn't focus on 2005?
The reversible error in the court's analysis is one. The concept of latches, one, we did not have a viable claim that arose until the default judgment existed. And that the court, however, determined that we had a claim, really, and could have asserted a claim going back as early as 1992. But the nature of the claim against Goldman Sachs is purely derivative in nature. It is like, and we analogized it in our brief, to a common law indemnity claim. That is, until we had liability for the environmental pollution against either the corporation or its legal successor, the successor trust, we had no ability to seek money against stockholders. Had the environmental litigation been successfully defended, and the district court in the Virgin Islands ruled that, in fact, there was no liability of either Panex or the successor trust, we never would have had a claim ripen against Goldman Sachs.
Well, Justice Ridgely asked you about latches, which is an equitable doctrine, and it seems that the vice chancellor's focus was on what he considered to be inequities, and he characterized Goldman Sachs as basically an innocent third party, and that it would be inequitable to recover from them now. Why was he wrong in that respect?
Well, I think there are two aspects to the response to that one. One, Your Honor, focuses on what a claim for unjust enrichment is, and then I'll come back to latches. I don't mean to not address the court's argument. But the first point is unjust enrichment at base really is an equitable concept that tries to address the situation where you have a loss and there are two arguably innocent parties involved, one of whom received a benefit, one of whom suffered a loss. And it's how do you allocate the loss between those two innocent parties where the wrongdoer, if you will, itself either cannot satisfy the judgment, does not have money to, or in this case no longer exists in the case of the corporation. So the concept of unjust enrichment looks at the equities in terms of saying, okay, where we have two innocent parties, we are going to essentially put the burden on the person who received a benefit without justification or where that person who received the benefit has interests that were aligned with the wrongdoer. Now, the lower court addressed that in a footnote later in its opinion where he noted and said, well, we, the Virgin Islands, ignored the concept that usually when you have a transfer of money and you assert a claim for unjust enrichment, there must have been some wrongdoing or a mistake in the transfer. But I think what the Aidenoff case says is, no, it doesn't have to be that there was a mistake necessarily. It's that where the person who received the money unjustly has interests that are aligned with the wrongdoer, then the third party who suffers a loss and is a purely innocent party should not be the one to incur that loss. That's where unjust enrichment kicks in.
But as you recall, on page 79 and 80 of the Vice Chancellor's opinion, in addition to everything you mentioned, he talks about the fact that certain events happened 25 years earlier, 21 years earlier, 18 years earlier, 14 years earlier, and 5 years earlier. And he, after going through that litany of benchmarks, he concludes, the Virgin Islands just waited too long. And notwithstanding everything you said in balancing the equities, they waited too long, which brings us back to 2005 as the linchpin of your argument.
And now let me get to the second part of the answer to your question, which is purely focused on latches and the prejudice to Goldman Sachs. The first answer I've already said, which is latches is not the relevant legal principle in our view. But if you adopt the Vice Chancellor's view and look at the events that occurred earlier, one, even if you could, if the Virgin Islands had a claim, and obviously all this is based on an assumption that the Virgin Islands actually had standing to bring a claim, which we contest they didn't. There also are on the equities, though, Goldman Sachs had the opportunity to deal with this earlier as well. As the court sets forth in its opinion, the Virgin Islands did, in the district court proceedings in the Virgin Islands previously, attempt to file a third-party complaint against Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs contested that on jurisdictional grounds, and ultimately the Virgin Islands essentially agreed and voluntarily dismissed that.
And what was that year?
Your Honor, that occurred in...
Is it 96?
It was 1996, Your Honor. So that was in 1996. Now, thereafter, there were several opportunities when the issue, again, the issue of whether or not there could be a claim against the stockholders was sought to be brought up by various parties. When the successor trustee itself was established, the trustees of the former liquidating trust attempted to argue that, look, claims against former stockholders are legally invalid.
Is there anything in the record that explains why nothing else happened involving Goldman Sachs after that 1996 dismissal?
Your Honor, one, I need to correct the date. I'm sorry. The dismissal of Goldman Sachs actually occurred in 1998. They were dismissed from the CERCLA case in February of 98. Was there anything else done with respect to Goldman Sachs? The answer is no. And again, the reason that nothing else was done was, at least for the Virgin Islands had no standing, in its view, to bring a claim. They were litigating the environmental action down in the district court in the Virgin Islands. The trust was defending it at that point in time, along with other parties who were named as defendants in that action. As we read Section 325 of the Code, the purpose of that is to essentially prevent direct actions against stockholders, or in this case, beneficiaries of liquidating trusts, unless and until an underlying liability has been established. So the answer to your question is no.
Does it refer to a judgment against the corporation?
Section 278? Yes.
And do you have that?
We have a judgment against the successor trust, not against the corporation.
Well, then why doesn't the plain language of the statute preclude you from pursuing the shareholders?
Because We are pursuing Goldman in its capacity as a beneficiary of the successor trust that was set up as the legal successor of Panex. City Investing, this court's opinion in City Investing, recognized that Section 278 does not apply to a liquidating trust, and it doesn't apply for a very straightforward reason. Section 278, as you point out, refers to the corporation. The liquidating trust is a separate legal entity, but that doesn't change the nature of what that entity is, which is it is a legal successor to the corporation. And that's what the holding of City Investing really stands for, which is where the company or the people running the company make a conscious decision to establish a legal successor, and that legal successor is charged with dealing with the liabilities and potential liabilities and winding up the affairs of the corporation, claims can still be asserted because there is a new independent legal entity in existence. And the three-year period under Section 278 has no application to such a liquidating trust. So that's why, Your Honor, despite the fact
although
that there's
a number of federal courts have concluded otherwise, right?
No, Your Honor. The cases that they rely on, which are the Third Circuit and the New York opinions, the Third Circuit did not address the question of stockholders, and the Vice Chancellor found that in his opinion below. They only addressed whether or not there were claims against officers and directors of the corporation. It was clear from the judgment that was entered that they did not address that issue as to stockholders. With respect to the New York opinions, one, obviously the New York federal court opinions are not binding on this court, but more important, the New York court in its opinions really did not directly address the question that we have here today, which is where there is a successor entity created like this liquidating trust, what is the scope of the claims that carry over from the corporation into that trust and that can be asserted for the recovery of money against stockholders or former stockholders who are now beneficiaries of the trust. That particular issue was never, as near as I can tell, directly presented or addressed by the New York District Court or the Second Circuit in its opinions. So, Your Honor, just coming back to the prejudice point, because I do want to round that out. At various times throughout the proceedings, Goldman Sachs chose not to involve itself. It claims prejudice now, saying, well, how are we going to defend ourselves and so on? Well, one, I submit that's a fact issue. Whether or not they suffer prejudice because of a lack of ability to obtain evidence or otherwise because of the passage of time is an issue of fact that can't be determined on this motion to dismiss record. In fact, latches itself is a fact-based defense. And to the extent, for example, the court below questions things such as, you know, whether the Virgin Islands was diligent in finding or discovering the pollution because it owned the property. Again, I submit that is a factual question that simply cannot be resolved on this motion to dismiss record. Looking over the proceedings that have occurred in other courts, Goldman Sachs absolutely has a right to assert defenses that it has wherever and whenever it has them. I don't deny that. I don't question that. But when you look at what has occurred over the years, Goldman Sachs also had the ability to protect itself. It knew that the original liquidating trust was extended because it received financial statements, and we allege that in the complaint, that showed that the original trust was extended beyond the three-year period. Again, a factual issue. Did Goldman Sachs go and figure out why the trust had been extended? Would there be anything to suggest that the trust was extended because of concerns over potential pollution claims? I don't know. That's not in the record, and I can't answer that. A factual question that can't be resolved on a motion to dismiss. In the District Court Virgin Islands proceedings, the third-party complaints were filed in 96, were supplementally dismissed in 98 because of lack of jurisdiction. Again, Goldman Sachs chose to assert personal jurisdiction there, but could have chosen to participate and could have participated in discovery, protected its interests. When the successor trustee petition, or the petition to set up the successor trustee was filed, that issue was raised again about the validity of these claims. When an appeal was taken from that, it was raised with this court, which did not reach it because it didn't need to resolve the appeal. Then we had the successor trustee who filed a petition seeking recovery of certain funds that had been paid out to successor trust beneficiaries.
Mr. Goldman Jamison, you're using the time you reserved. You have 2 minutes total time left. Would you like to save that?
I do. Just one last comment, Your Honor. In the successor trustee petition, again, Goldman was involved in those proceedings, was present when that occurred, and again, could have stepped up and chosen to participate and protected its interests. So for those reasons, Your Honor, I think their claims of prejudice, one, depend on factual conclusions, and two, are overblown. I will reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, Melvin Brosterman on behalf of Goldman Sachs, the appellee. Rejoinder or response to the defense of latches and statute of limitations in this case is the most extraordinary defense or rejoinder that I have ever heard. And the defense is that since the party who was sued many, many years later, namely Goldman Sachs, knew that it might get sued because indeed it was sued in 1996, that Goldman Sachs cannot rely on a statute of limitations that, in our view, expired many, many years ago, okay, because it chose to move to dismiss the 1996 complaint, among other things, on the grounds of lack of personal jurisdiction. The complaint was dismissed on the grounds of lack of personal jurisdiction, and then Goldman Sachs was no longer a party to a proceeding. So the theory is that since Goldman Sachs knew it might get sued because it was sued in 1996, which, by the way, was way too late in any event, Goldman Sachs had some sort of responsibility to bring a declaratory judgment action, to wave its hands, to say, please sue me, or I'll remain in the Virgin Islands as a defendant, because absent that, Goldman Sachs somehow is precluded from arguing that the statute of limitations bars this. Okay? Not surprisingly, I don't believe there's any case from this court or any of the courts of the state which suggests that a party who is dismissed out of a case where the statute of limitations is not told, okay, years later cannot argue statute of limitations as a defense to a claim that's brought thereafter. The Virgin Islands claims that it did not have standing until 2005, okay, because it brings this claim derivatively on behalf of Panax and the Panax Trust. In its complaint at paragraph 50, it actually says it brings this claim individually and as assignee. And notwithstanding the fact that there have been dozens of pages written about Panax, including a very large and very thorough decision by Vice Chancellor Strine, the complaint is all of 12 pages long. Not very much there. And what the complaint says in paragraph 57 and 58, and it really focuses on what this case is all about, is that this is a claim that arises out of the pollution by Panax of the Laga facility, or through the Laga facility of this aquifer. Okay, and that claim was not discovered, according to the complaint, okay, until sometime in the 1990s, at paragraph 40 of the complaint. So the basic claim, it says, is it is unfair and unjust to foist environmental damages caused by the activities of Panax Industries onto the taxpayers of the USVI while allowing Goldman Sachs to profit. So let's make no mistake, the claim here is a claim of a creditor, or someone who claims years later to have been that they should have been a creditor of Panax, to recover for liability that Panax caused them, or for damages that Panax caused them. And the claim is to recover that money now from a shareholder. And 325B is explicit. If the claim is one of a creditor of the corporation, then you cannot sue a shareholder of the corporation for the debts of that corporation until you have an unsatisfied judgment against the corporation.
Well, your opponent suggests that, well, you're not really a shareholder, you're a beneficiary, and therefore that makes the difference.
Okay. As a shareholder, okay, we received liquidating distributions. Had we not received liquidating distributions or a dividend, there would never be a claim. In other words, you can't sue an innocent shareholder for the debts of a corporation under any legal theory unless they have received something from that corporation. You can, for example, sue them on a theory of fraudulent conveyance if there has been a fraudulent conveyance, a transfer of assets for less than fair consideration. They can be sued if there's an illegal dividend under Section 174 of the Delaware General Corporation Law. Okay. Interestingly, both those provisions have, in the first instance, I think it's a 4-year statute of limitations from the date of the distribution, and a 6-year statute of limitation. So there can be no claim against a shareholder for unjust enrichment, as we have here, unless there was something that the shareholder received. Okay? And there can be no claim, therefore, that would be subject to 325B against the shareholder, absent the receipt by the shareholder of something. So the shareholder necessarily has to be a beneficiary of something, whether it's a dividend or a distribution or a fraudulent conveyance of something, before there can be any claim against the shareholder in the first instance, which means, of course, that 325B would govern that. And 325B is quite explicit. Moreover, the claim that he says he has, or that the Virgin Islands says they have, is derivative. They have one individually and one as assignee. It is derivative of the claim of Panax, derivative of the claim of the liquidating trust and the successor trust. It's worth exploring that just for a moment. Panax never had a claim against its shareholders arising out of the LAGA environmental liability. And the reason it never had such a claim is because it only would have a claim for recoupment if the corporation itself had some liability and had to have paid creditors. Panax, as we know, never paid the Virgin Islands or any other creditor a nickel relating to environmental claims because nobody knew about the existence of the claims at the time that Panax, or prior to the time of its dissolution and 3 years following the dissolution. So Panax doesn't have a claim. And any claim they have derivative of Panax's doesn't exist. The liquidating trust, by the same token, liquidating trust paid out a much smaller amount of distributions. The liquidating trust also paid those monies out at a time when it did not know of the prospect or the possibility of a claim by the Virgin Islands. And the liquidating trust itself has never been the subject of a judgment by the Virgin Islands or anyone else, which would allow the liquidating trust to then seek to recoup monies that it inadvertently, mistakenly, incorrectly paid out to creditors, the shareholders at a time that there was a claim pending against it. The successor trust, and that's where the Virgin Islands has its judgment, has no claim, because the successor trust, okay, as everyone knows and nobody disputes it, never paid out any money. So whatever claim the successor trust has, it's not independent, it's not its own claim, it is a claim that would have arisen as a result of something that the liquidating trust owned or the Panax owned. Since neither Panax or the liquidating trust was ever liable to pay a nickel for the environmental liability, never paid on anything, they have no possibility of recouping any money.
As you heard, Mr. Jameson put some emphasis on the fact that in the trust created by the Court of Chancery, there was a reference to claims, if any, that the Virgin Islands might have, and he says that gives credence to the viability of his claims. But it appears that Vice Chancellor Strine reads the document as saying, claims, if any, and he says specifically that the Court of Chancery was not making any determination on the merits as to whether there were claims or they would survive.
And I believe, Your Honor, that this Court did the same in the Rosenblum case, because in the Rosenblum case, which in the long history of Panax is one of the other decisions, at page, and this is the reported copy of the decision, Your Honor, at page 460 of the reported copy of the decision, it says Vice Chancellor, referring to, I suppose at the time, Vice Chancellor Steele, the Vice Chancellor specifically and carefully refrained from deciding whether or not a recoupment or restitution action would be necessary or appropriate, leaving that for further analysis by the successor trustee. The fact that the successor trustee has initiated such an action does not mean that his effort is immune from review, which is to say that not only has Vice Chancellor Strine concluded, as Your Honor as mentioned a moment ago, but this Court, indeed, read Vice Chancellor Steele's order in the very same fashion.
To the extent that's the law of the case, we don't read anything into referencing the existence of the possibility of a claim.
That's correct. I mean, the Vice Chancellor Steele was confronted with the exigencies of the circumstances. It had 2 weeks, 2 weeks between the date of the hearing on the order and the date that the trust was to about to expire in which to act. And I think as a practical matter, no matter how comprehensive or thorough there could have been no hearing on the merits of a claim in that period of time, nor was there, and the successive trust order does not provide for that. Okay.
Now, how do we distinguish this case, or do we, from the city investing case that the other side relies heavily upon?
City investing is distinguishable from city investing in terms of the claims that they've asserted. City investing stands for the proposition, which we don't disagree with. It's a decision of the courts of the state that if a trust assumes certain liabilities. And in city investing, there were fairly large assumptions of liabilities, that the trust may itself be sued for those liabilities. And what happened in city investing is that the trust was sued by the surety that had paid out claims for the corporation prior to, that had been dissolved. And the surety had an indemnification arrangement with the corporation, which was specifically assumed by the trust. So the surety then sues the trust on that indemnification claim, saying that since the trust has assumed all liabilities, one of them being this indemnification obligation, I can proceed against the trust to satisfy that on that obligation to satisfy the claim that I have. We don't dispute that, and frankly it's irrelevant, that if the liquidating trust had assumed all of the liabilities of Panax, and the successor trust in turn assumed all of the liabilities of Panax, and let's assume that's the case for purposes of this because it doesn't change the result here. The only thing that the Virgin Islands could have done is if it had a claim that was not otherwise barred against Panax or barred against the liquidating trust, time barred that is, is it could proceed against the successor trust to recover for that liability. But proceeding against the successor trust means that its recovery is limited by the assets of the successor trust. If the successor trust had $50 million in it and it had a viable claim that had not been time barred, obviously the successor trust at $50 million no doubt would have defended the claim as opposed to have simply defaulted. But that what city investing says is that the trust itself is liable to pay a judgment for any liabilities that the trust itself has assumed. City investing does not say what they say, that city investing extends the life of the corporation and allows you thereby to escape the explicit language of 325B. So city investing is the law of the state, and city investing does not change the result in this case. What changes the result is if you interpret city investing to eviscerate 325B. Okay, and statutorily, the legislature of Delaware has told us that you cannot bring an action against a shareholder for the debts of a corporation unless you first have a judgment against the corporation. It doesn't use the word corporation and or liquidating trust. It uses the word corporation. So all that city investing did is give them a right to proceed against the liquidating trust and to recover based upon whatever assets the liquidating trust has. Nothing more, nothing less. It doesn't change the result here. They have this notion that the Virgin Islands claims that the claim did not ripen until 2005. In fact, in their reply brief, in their opening brief at page 7, they say that the claim ripened in August 1996 when the record of decision was issued by the EPA finding that there was liability arising out of the environmental pollution at the facility. So we know, by their own admission, that the claim did not first ripen in 2005 because the claim, and assuming it did, assuming all they have here is that which belonged to the successor trust had no right of recoupment because the successor trust never made any distributions, never paid out any money. The liquidating trust made distributions at a time there were no lager-related claims relating to it and therefore had no right and never paid out on lager-related claims and therefore did not have the right to recoup to satisfy those claims. Similarly, Panax never paid out on any lager-related claims and also didn't. And even assuming they all had such rights, even assuming they had paid out and they had claims, the successor trust would still be subject to the to all of the defenses available to the against the liquidating trust and against Panax. Okay. The statute of limitations under 10 Delaware Code 8106, Virgin Islands does not dispute is applicable here, would have given each of these entities 3 years to bring a claim following the date of that distribution, because the unjust enrichment, the enrichment that occurred absent the justification, and of course there was a justification at the time because there was no knowledge of a claim, those claims would have risen in the case of Panax at the time it made the distributions. It would have had 3 years, which would have expired by 1988, because the last distribution it made was 85. The liquidating trust, which paid out in 1987, its claim for recoupment, if it had such a claim, and as I explained, we don't believe it did, would have expired in 1990. And the successor trust, okay, frankly, had no independent claim, and it was stuck with whatever it received from the liquidating trust, whose claim, if at all, would have long since been barred by the statute of limitations in 1990. So, okay, we have a 12-page complaint, or this court has a 12-page complaint before it. Okay, it is very clear, notwithstanding the arguments in the briefs, that Goldman had that there is no allegation in this complaint that suggests that Goldman had any knowledge of environmental problems associated with it. To the contrary, the complaint is very clear in stating that the lager facility that nobody knew until the 1990s that the lager facility was the source of pollution at the 22 the 22 aquifer. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Your Honor, two very brief comments in my time that remains. One is, with respect to counsel's suggestion that we admitted that a claim arose in August of 1996, he's referring to the wrong claim. The claim that arose in August of 1996 was the Virgin Islands' ability to pursue a NRD, or environmental claim, for polluters. In other words, as I understand the environmental statutes, and this is why we put them in our briefs, until the EPA issues its record of decision, which it did in 96, there is no ability of the territory to begin filing claims for the cleanup costs associated with that. My second point, Your Honor, relates to city investing. I submit that Goldman reads city investing too narrowly and that the lower court did as well. City investing made clear that these liquidating trust agreements are drafted between parties who do not have the interests of the creditors or potential creditors of a dissolving corporation in mind, but that they must be read to protect those interests. That is what city investing stands for. So to suggest that, for example, and in city investing, it was the case that the court rejected an effort to narrowly read the trust agreement in a way that would have prevented recovery on behalf of creditors. When you read it with the purpose in mind, which is a liquidating trust is set up in order to protect creditors and potential creditors, then you have to read the language of the trust expansively in order to accomplish that purpose. That's what city investing stands for. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Jameson. Mr. Brosterman, the court appreciates your arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement, and we'll also take a brief recess.